Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore is my co-host. And we are continuing our conversation with author Mairead Case about her latest book, Tiny, which is a reimagining of Antigone, the Sophocles Greek play. But of course, this is set in modern times, and really there are elements of it, but it is its own book. But there are so many pop culture references to this, and I know, Arsene, you're excited by some of the music references and various different things.
Oh, yeah.
Mairead, as we were saying in the broadcast interview, you've so many notes about the various different pieces of inspiration that you had as part of the book.
Yeah, there's something for everybody. One thing I noticed as being a fan of Kathleen Hanna was there was a Bikini Kill reference and a La Tigra reference. So, and Kathleen Hanna is one of the main people in the Riot Girl movement. And so I guess, does that movement inform the book a little bit? I mean, there are definitely some things that they espouse that I feel are common with what's going on in the book.
Absolutely, yeah. And I grew up in Seattle, and so, you know, Riot Girl definitely shaped how I understood myself as a teenager, and I also think that it's given me tools to shift. I don't identify with it in the way that I used to, but the idea of resisting psychic death and the idea of needing to like be in your body and going out and talking to people and holding to your truths, I think is a really powerful and important thing.
So this book is set in the Pacific Northwest, albeit it's never explicitly said. Now, at the beginning, it does outline who the people are, people and birds, and the place. And the place is by the water in a city full of moss and blown out pearly light. That seems very Pacific Northwesty. So is it Seattle?
It is, yeah. And like, you know, when I was a kid, my mother was always like, maybe this is a little too gray for you. And I was like, no, I'm fine. I love being sad. And then when I came to Colorado, I was like, oh, light makes you happier. But you know, there's like so many greens in that part of the world. Like
I don't think of it as gray. Because it is so lush.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly.
You know, I suppose it's not the sunshine, but you have the greenery.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's so beautiful, the landscape.
And it glows in a certain way. Exactly. That's what I always told my mom.
So did you come to Colorado to go to DU?
I did.
So tell us about that program. We've interviewed other people in that DU PhD program. We've interviewed Stephen Dunn. We interviewed Mark Mayer. We interviewed Mona Awad. What? Laird Hunt was a teacher at the program.
Program.
So tell us about that program a little bit, because it really is a big part of the Colorado literary landscape, and what you got from it, or you know how it worked for you.
Absolutely. For me too, Naropa was a big part of it as well. I didn't know about the summer writing program, and I read a tweet somewhere where someone was posting the lineup for that summer, and I ended up being lucky enough to be able to come out here and study. And that was where I realized that you could go to a PhD for creative writing. And so I met Laird that summer. And then within the year, I ended up moving out here. And I worked at Naropa for a long time. I still teach there and going to the program at DU. And I really love the fact that like you can do a rigorous research space and really kind of get into bigger philosophical questions in that PhD, but then also like write something that many people are able to read in different ways. It felt really important to work on something that I cared about and then make it be really accessible. And so I loved being able to go there. I feel lucky that I had that opportunity in my life.
It seems like a lot of really original works are coming out of there, not just traditional chapter one, chapter two, chapter three novels. Stephen Dunn's book incorporated pictures and comics and all sorts
manuals
from the army. I mean, it was all sorts of stuff. Mona Awad, you know, was written all sorts of stuff. Mark Mayer's was kind of a collected short story volume, with tied together. So is there something there that encourages that, or is it just this exploration and the research? Or
I think it's all the things. It's certainly a lot of the teachers, like Sela Satterstrom in particular, I think really encourages like a hybrid approach to writing and listening and being in the world, because that's how we all are anyway. You know, we think in like words and pictures, and I like that that program really encourages you to put that down on the page as well. But it's also, you're in classes with people that are there for a more traditional master's program, and you work in a writing center, and you do art explorations, and so it really is a chance to grow your brain in different ways and start different kinds of conversations.
You know, somebody wanted to grow their brain, which I might do. They could just look at your bibliography for this book, which, A, to have a bibliography of a novel is very unusual, but then your bibliography, which I wasn't surprised to see several different versions of Antigone in the bibliography, but you also had, just to name a few, James Baldwin, Nan Goldin's photographs, A Wrinkle in Time. So what was the influence of some of those things? Like, how does Nan Goldin fit in? How does A Wrinkle in Time fit into this overall book?
Nan Goldin, I went to a an interdisciplinary MFA program. So I studied writing, but then I also would do crits with like a painting class or go walk around the museum. And that was a really lucky and wonderful time in my life. And one of the classes that I took, we studied Nan Goldin, and she has this beautiful book, The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, which is beautiful in like all of its emotions, right? You don't necessarily feel happy all the time when you're reading it, but it's really powerful. And she talked about how in the beginning she would try and write when she was in all these spaces, but then she would get back home and wouldn't be able to read what she wrote for any number of reasons. And so then she just started like taking pictures. And so she was really present, but then she found a way to remember it and take those stories out and help people and you know, move through life in that way. And so that for me feels a lot of what Tiny is like when she's on the dance floor. It's like everything at once, and you leave and you're like, okay, what's in my pocket? And Wrinkle in Time is about a girl who really understands time and really knows that her dad has to go away. And she always believes that he's going to come back. And that emotion felt was something that I looked at how Lengel wrote that on the page and hoped to bring some of that into Tiny.
You grew up in Seattle.
I did.
You were saying, I'm assuming it was an Irish family because I think you give a shout out to your sister Siobhan.
Yep.
So between Siobhan and Red, you don't inflict names like that on children unless you've got good reason.
It's
as
true,
I always say when I gave my children unpronounceable Irish names as well. You said in the broadcast interview that your mother always talked about death. I find, having grown up in Ireland, there's a very different relationship to death, and certainly for children. You go to funerals, you go to wakes, there's a body laid out, and you see, you know what I mean?
It's absolutely,
it's very different from the experience here. And I was just wondering, was that because maybe your mother was from an Irish family, or what how did that manifest itself to talk about death as part of your family and just your childhood?
I mean, absolutely. I remember being little and my mom took me to a funeral, and she was like, I want you to look at the body and ask me any questions that you have. And she's like, I want the first time that you are near a dead body to have it be a body that you don't know personally, so that you can just be in this space. And I really, it's such a heavy metal thing to say, but it also
is pretty out there for your mom.
You know, but it's like very, like, it is very Irish. It's very Catholic. It's like, you know, let's look at this space and be here and take care of each other. And, you know, the basement after something like that, you've got all the Jell-O salads and like all the snacks and like the coffee and the styrofoam. And I think that's the first time that I really understood that, like, you could live through a sad thing and that there were other beginnings after endings, which is such a beautiful thing to learn from my mom, but, you know, something that I've also struggled with as I moved through my life in different ways.
Yeah, that idea that you can move through grief, even if it is completely overwhelming at a certain point in your time, in your life. There, you know, that's really the theme of Tiny, that you can move beyond that and envision a future beyond that too.
Yeah, because so much of the writing and experiences that we see, because I think it's easier to put them out that way, is to say this is an end and you will always be hurting. And that's true, but also you know, I know we've all experienced grief too. It's like you also experience joy, and you can know a deeper joy as you move through it. And that's not like an overly cheerful thing to say at all. It's like a really cool part of being a human. So absolutely.
Yeah, it does seem that we do need to have language around death and how we talk about it, because I've done a lot of broadcasting and coverage and shows on death and how to die and what does death look like and how do we normalize it, because everyone's going to die, but we don't talk about it and we don't like to think about it either, you know?
Yeah. And just, you know, it is in so many places, and like, it can be really hard to sit with things that scare you. But like a thing that I tell my students is it's like you hit a point where then you understand it better. And maybe it doesn't mean that you can define it for somebody else, but like it becomes more of like a friend that's on your shoulder instead of something that you like can't even compute. And that's really important.
Yeah. Tiny knows death intimately. I mean, she finds her brother in a car.
Mm-hmm.
And but she knows before she actually sees her brother, she knows almost as she's going up to the car that there's death there, that sense of death, you know, that death is beyond the physical thing, mm-hmm. I think is pervades this book quite a bit.
Yeah. And the dread with it, because she knew that he was kind of already gone. And I think she always knew that she would find him. And there's this minute in that scene where she's like, I could just leave now and someone else would find him and I could pretend like I never did this. But for her, in a way similar to Sophocles, when she actually does like bury her brother out in the desert around the city, she makes a decision that like connects her to the event forever.
And then she also talks about how, you know, her mother who died when she was 3, and then when her brother dies, they live on in certain ways, mm-hmm. as well. So they're not just gone, because I think a lot of people think that it's like, well, they're dead, so they're gone. They're no longer here in the physical way that they were, but there are ways that people still live on in your life.
Yeah, and that you're in your body too, right? That's part of the basement after the ceremony thing. You got to go down and eat some cake, and like, even if you can't talk, if you like are digesting something, that means that you're moving through it in a certain way.
So I was thinking about this book in a larger societal way too. I mean, or even political, you know, where we're, you know, Biden just announced we're going to pull out of Afghanistan. And, mm-hmm. but I imagine most of this book was written probably during what hopefully we'll just refer to as the Trump era, and it's done, but who knows? Mm-hmm. And now, so, you know, and with the safe spaces, that seemed, you know, it's always going to be important. It's not like it's suddenly not important, but it seemed very, very important these last 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think, as things are going on, and you look at your students, the 8th graders, and the world they're moving out into, how do you feel about what they're moving out into versus what you moved out into 20 years ago? You know, like, are things getting better? Better is a weird word, but how are things different? How are things better? How are things worse?
I mean, I truly do think that they are better. And I truly do think that like teenagers in the world today, like because of this clarity where it's like, no, we have to mourn, we have to move through this, or we have to dance. Like, I really do believe that the world is in good hands. And I believe they deserve a better world to grow from, but they don't have that in this moment. But I really like being able to teach during the pandemic has really brought a certain kind of hope, even as I've seen my students struggle in very real ways. Like, they have an incredible power that can only do good in the world. But yeah, I think a lot about like what safety is. And one of the things that I talk with my students about a lot is that kind of like complicated feeling you get in your gut when like, you know, am I or am I not going to watch this footage? Or how am I going to talk about these injustices and this inequity in the world? How am I going to think about this war? Like, that sort of I want to barf feeling isn't, I think it just means that you know it's bigger than you and that these are things that we can't just fix as ourselves. Like, we're often taught that if we analyze something, we can fix it on our own, which is what Bear thinks in the book, Tiny's dad. And like, you really can. Like, he has to listen to his daughter more. And so I think the idea of being safe to be who you are in a space that might be different than feeling comfortable, but it's an important road that we're all on together.
One of the things I noticed by its absence in the book was the lack of, say, social media or technology, and that wouldn't necessarily fit with just how the book is written, but Tiny's relationships, whether it's with Izzy or Hank or any of the other characters in the book, they're very much in person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where now it seems, or maybe this is because I'm not a teenager now, but it does seem that we think teens are only communicating through technology these days. And,
mm-hmm.
and that, because obviously it's changed fundamentally how young people and really how everyone has communicated, and especially during the pandemic. But was that a conscious thing that Tiny wasn't going to update her whatever page she would be on. Or
yeah, I think it was. It's also like the Greek chorus is such a powerful thing. And so there are moments in the book where it's in a certain kind of third person and they're saying how she must feel about something. And in some ways that's, you know, a rude move that the chorus can make. But it's also kind of like social media, I feel, because of the way that we're put into binary language when we're on there, even if we try not to. So that felt like a Greek chorus was kind of already built in there anyway. But yeah, she definitely, it felt like adding tech into it would have been too many sounds in the narrative.
You know, it's funny you say that because about the Greek chorus and looking at Tiny from the outside, because in some ways that passage you read was mm-hmm. all third person. When Tiny mm-hmm. loved Hank, this happened and that happened. And some of those, it's very beautiful, but also some of them almost seem like Instagram moments. Like mm-hmm. it's looking at the love from the outside. Really, mm-hmm. right? I thought that was interesting, looking at her both, like being able to look at it from the outside, but also other passages you're very much within her.
Yeah, and she's also like, no, we're in love. You know, I think it's easy to like look at like a photo or like look back on your on a moment in your life and be like, well, were we really in love? Or like, you know, when you're like meeting someone for the first time, you're like, are they just being nice to me? Or do they really think I'm a total weirdo? And is that good or bad? You know, but like for her to look back and be like, no, we were in love then and I know it. Feels really helpful and true.
It's very mm-hmm. authentic. So I do think very often when teen love and first loves and those very deep emotions that are felt at that age, when they're described in popular culture, it's almost done in a sort of a little bit snide. It's like, well, you don't really know. You haven't gotten mm-hmm. a life experience to really understand. Those are such huge, powerful emotions mm-hmm. to live through at that age. And for her to have the confidence, it was like, no, this was real and I stand with that. That was really, really refreshing and really nice.
Yeah, and they know they're probably not going to be together forever, but they know that they're going to walk with each other until they get to that like threshold. And that, I think, is something I didn't know at that period of time. I was always like, I'll be with you forever. This is it. Or it won't be anything. But they look out for each other in that way.
I mean, no matter what happens to them in the future, it's better than what happened to Antigone and her love in mm-hmm. Sophocles, right?
Yeah.
That didn't end too well.
Yeah, no, it didn't. and that's the thing, too. In the original play, like, there isn't that much action. Like, her brother's already buried, and then she and, like, Haman die in the tomb together in some versions, or he dies outside. It's like there's no action. It's just right. like bodies.
And then, yeah, and then the mother kills herself as well too. Like there's just a lot of bodies at the end.
Yeah. That's yeah.
And where you have a lot of hope at the end.
Yeah, that was important to flip it that way because you know it's always the similar side of a certain coin, and then that's how you get the whole right.
Well, I heard you were working on a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so? How do you go from being inspired by a Greek play, Sophocles, to graphic novel? What's the process for that? Are you doing the illustrations as well as the
no,
text?
My friend David Lasky is doing the illustrations, and I think it's all collaboration, right? Like if you're in the world and you meet different people and you hear different sounds and see different things, you get to work in different media. And so there's a historical steam plant in Seattle, just outside of Seattle, that brought power to the city in really powerful ways. And so we were commissioned to make a graphic novel about it that will be distributed to students in the area and different kinds of people that are interested in the steam plant. And that story is also narrated by a young girl. So for me, that's the connection to stay in that tone of voice. But I love doing collaborations with people. You learn more, you become bigger, you listen better. It feels important.
What's the process of writing a graphic novel? Because, I mean, I think of speech bubbles, but then you have other texts. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not obviously the same as writing, you know,
right.
a regular piece of prose. But, you know, what is the process of writing a graphic novel?
I think in both you start, for me, I start with a bunch of research. And I think about the different sorts of elements that I want to include, which ultimately comes from Richard Hugo and the way he talked about a triggering town. Like here are all these elements. How do you, it's kind of like being like a little kid and like thinking about how you're going to play with your toys and like, here's how this one's going to work and that one. And you know, the elements aren't toys, but that sort of openness in your brain and where can we go here feels important. And then you collaborate. And so David and I have known each other for a long time and we've talked about different images that we want in and how to work text in a way where it's not just like a subtitle and it really is kind of sewn into the work itself. And then you just have a lot of conversations and talk with a lot of stakeholders and you make the work.
I mean, yeah, this would make an awesome graphic novel, which you could then, you know, my daughter reads a lot of things. She's 12, mm-hmm. but her love is the graphic novel. Like, she would read. And what I see with the kids, too, is that they read the graphic novels 3, 4, 5 times. They really, yeah. really absorb it. And this is a book that invites rereading, like poetry. You know, mm-hmm. it does invite, like, a closer look or going back. And after I had finished it a few nights ago, I did go back and read several passages again and kept finding new stuff or connections. So that would be an amazing project, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, anytime a work can, like, have more conversations, either with, like, you now and future you or, like, you and other people, it's, like, I think that's important.
And I think we'll have to have another podcast someday where we just talk about Richard Hugo.
Yeah, it's true. Yep.
One of my favorite books is his poetry book, which was, I always mess it up. I think it's 31 Letters and 13 Dreams, mm-hmm. even though it could be the opposite. I think it's 31 Letters, 13 Dreams, which, oh my God, I just love that book. And I was obsessed with it. And then I read it before I had moved to Boulder, and then some of the letters yeah. are written to people in Boulder, so that made it even greater. But he was a poet who, he probably died 30 years ago now. It's been a while, but he was enormously influential to lots of writers, I think.
Absolutely, and I used to work at a Richard Hugo House in Seattle, which was how I first knew about him, and I learned a lot from Francis McHugh, and just... He wrote a lot about death, and I think he was stuck in it in some ways. He's certainly more like Bear, Tiny's dad, than Tiny, but, like, thinking about someone who would write about those stories in a way that, like, I could hear really well, he was really important for me in that way.
Well, Mairead Case has been our guest at After Hours at the Radio Book Club. If you didn't listen to the broadcast edition yet, just go back and listen to that, because we talk a lot more about her latest novel, Tiny. And it's been great to have you in the Radio Book Club right here at the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you, Mairead.
Thank you so much for having me.
And don't forget to subscribe to the Radio Book Club so you can catch all the bonus After Hours content and all the back episodes and just, you know, listen to all these great interviews we're doing with these wonderful authors. And it's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. As always, I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, my co-host. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.